It is the only way we can live. Those with the tragic vision are unmoved by ringing declarations attributed to the first-person plural we, our, and us. They are more likely to use the pronouns as the cartoon possum Pogo did. We have met the enemy, and he is us. We are all members of the same flawed species. Putting our moral vision into practice means imposing our will on others. The human lust for power and esteem, coupled with its vulnerability to self-deception and self-righteousness, makes that an invitation to a calamity, all the worse when that power is directed at a goal as quixotic as eradicating human self-interest. As the conservative philosopher Michael Oakeshott wrote, "To try to do something which is inherently impossible is always a corrupting enterprise." The two kinds of visionaries thereby line up on opposite sides of many issues that would seem to have little in common. The utopian vision seeks to articulate social goals and devise policies that target them directly. Economic inequality is attacked in a war on poverty, pollution by environmental regulations, racial imbalances by preferences, carcinogens by bans on food additives. The tragic vision points to the self-interested motives of the people who would implement these policies, namely the expansion of their bureaucratic fiefdoms, and to their ineptitude at anticipating the myriad consequences, especially when the social goals are pitted against millions of people pursuing their own interests. Thus, say the tragic visionaries, the utopians fail to anticipate that welfare might encourage dependency, or that a restriction on one pollutant might force people to use another. Instead, the tragic vision looks to systems that produce desirable outcomes even when no member of the system is particularly wise or virtuous. Market economies, in this vision, accomplish that goal. Remember Smith's butcher, brewer, and baker providing us with dinner out of self-interest rather than benevolence. No mastermind has to understand the intricate flow of goods and services that make up an economy in order to anticipate who needs what and when and where. Property rights give people an incentive to work and produce. Contracts allow them to enjoy gains in trade. Prices convey information about scarcity and demand to producers and consumers, so they can react by following a few simple rules. Make more of what is profitable, buy less of what is expensive, and the invisible hand will do the rest. The intelligence of the system is distributed across millions of not necessarily intelligent producers and consumers, and cannot be articulated by anyone in particular. People with the utopian vision point to market failures that can result from having a blind faith in free markets. They also call attention to the unjust distribution of wealth that tends to be produced by free markets. Opponents with the tragic vision argue that the notion of justice makes sense only when applied to human decisions within a framework of laws, not when applied to an abstraction called society. Friedrich Hayek wrote, "The manner in which the benefits and burdens are apportioned by the market mechanism would in many instances have to be regarded as very unjust if it were the result of a deliberate allocation to particular people." But that concern with social justice rests on a confusion, he claimed, because the particulars of a spontaneous order cannot be just or unjust. Some of today's battles between left and right fall directly out of these different philosophies. Big versus small government, high versus low taxes, protectionism versus free trade, measures that aim to reduce undesirable outcomes, poverty, inequality, racial imbalance, versus measures that merely level the playing field and enforce the rules. Other battles follow in a less obvious way from the opposing visions of human potential. The tragic vision stresses fiduciary duties, even when the person executing them cannot see their immediate value, because they allow imperfect beings who cannot be sure of their virtue or foresight to participate in a tested system. The utopian vision stresses social responsibility, where people hold their actions to a higher ethical standard. In Lawrence Kohlberg's famous theory of moral development, a willingness to ignore rules in favor of abstract principles was literally identified as a higher stage, which, perhaps tellingly, most people never reach. The most obvious example is the debate on strict constructionism and judicial restraint on one side, and judicial activism in pursuit of social justice on the other. Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court from 1954 to 1969, was the prototypical judicial activist who led the court to implement desegregation and expand the rights of the accused. He was known for interrupting lawyers in mid-argument by asking, "Is it right? Is it good?" The opposing view was stated by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said his job was to see that the game is played according to the rules, whether I like them or not. He conceded that to improve conditions of life and the race is the main thing, and added, "But how the devil can I tell whether I am not pulling it down more in some other place?" Those with the tragic vision see judicial activism as an invitation to egotism and caprice, and as unfair to those who have played by the rules as they were publicly stated. Those with the utopian vision see judicial restraint as the mindless preservation of arbitrary injustices. As Dickens's Mr. Bumble put it, "The law is an ass." An infamous example is the Dred Scott decision of 1856, in which the Supreme Court ruled on narrow legalistic grounds that a freed slave could not sue to make his freedom official, and that Congress could not prohibit slavery in federal territories. Radical political reform, like radical judicial reform, will be more or less appealing depending on one's confidence in human intelligence and wisdom. In the utopian vision, solutions to social problems are readily available. Speaking in 1967 about the conditions that breed violence, Lyndon Johnson said, "All of us know what those conditions are. Ignorance, discrimination, slums, poverty, disease, not enough jobs." If we already know the solutions, all we have to do is choose to implement them, and that requires only sincerity and dedication. By the same logic, anyone opposing the solutions must be motivated by blindness, dishonesty, and callousness. Those with the tragic vision say instead that solutions to social problems are elusive. The inherent conflicts of interests among people leave us with few options, all of them imperfect. Opponents of radical reform are showing a wise distrust of human hubris. The political orientation of the universities is another manifestation of conflicting visions of human potential. Adherents of the tragic vision distrust knowledge stated in explicitly articulated and verbally justified propositions, which is the stock in trade of academics, pundits, and policy analysts. Instead, they trust knowledge that is distributed diffusely throughout a system, such as a market economy or set of social mores, and which is tuned by adjustments by many simple agents using feedback from the world. Cognitive scientists will be reminded of the distinction between symbolic representations and distributed neural networks, and that is no coincidence. Hayek, the foremost advocate of distributed intelligence in societies, was an early neural network modeler. For much of the 20th century, political conservatism had an anti-intellectual streak, until conservatives decided to play catch-up in the battle for hearts and minds and funded policy think tanks as a counterweight to universities. Finally, the disagreements on crime and war fall right out of the conflicting theories of human nature. Given the obvious waste and cruelty of war, those with the utopian vision see it as a kind of pathology that arises from misunderstandings, short-sightedness, and irrational passions. War is to be prevented by public expressions of pacifist sentiments, better communication between potential enemies, less saber-rattling rhetoric, fewer weapons and military alliances, a de-emphasis on patriotism, and negotiating to avert war at any cost. Adherents of the tragic vision, with their cynical view of human nature, see war as a rational and tempting strategy for people who think they can gain something for themselves or their nation. The calculations might be mistaken in any instance, and they may be morally deplorable because they give no weight to the suffering of the losers, but they are not literally pathological or irrational. On this view, the only way to ensure peace is to raise the cost of war to potential aggressors by developing weaponry, arousing patriotism, rewarding bravery, flaunting one's might and resolve, and negotiating from strength to deter blackmail. The same arguments divide the visions on crime. Those with the utopian vision see crime as inherently irrational and seek to prevent it by identifying the root causes. Those with the tragic vision see crime as inherently rational and believe that the root cause is all too obvious. People rob banks because that's where the money is. The most effective crime prevention programs, they say, strike directly at the rational incentives. A high probability of unpleasant punishment raises the anticipated cost of crime. A public emphasis on personal responsibility helps enforce the incentives by closing any loopholes left open by the law. And strict parenting practices allow children to internalize these contingencies early in life. And onto this battlefield strode an innocent E.O. Wilson. The ideas from evolutionary biology and behavioral genetics that became public in the 1970s could not have been more of an insult to those with the utopian vision. That vision was, after all, based on the blank slate, no permanent human nature, the noble savage, no selfish or evil instincts, and the ghost in the machine, an unfettered we that can choose better social arrangements. And here were scientists talking about selfish genes and saying that adaptations are not for the good of the species, but for the good of individuals and their kin, as if to vindicate Thatcher's claim that there is no such thing as society. That people scrimp on altruism because it is vulnerable to cheaters. That in pre-state societies men go to war even when they are well-fed because status and women are permanent Darwinian incentives. That the moral sense is riddled with biases, including a tendency to self-deception, and that conflicts of genetic interest are built into social animals and leave us in a state of permanent tragedy. It looked as if scientists were saying to proponents of the tragic vision, "You're right, they're wrong." The utopians, particularly those in the radical science movement, replied that current findings on human intelligence and motivation are irrelevant. They can tell us only about what we have achieved in today's society, not what we might achieve in tomorrow's. Since we know that social arrangements can change if we decide to change them, any scientist who speaks of constraints on human nature must want oppression and injustice to continue. My own view is that the new sciences of human nature really do vindicate some version of the tragic vision and undermine the utopian outlook that until recently dominated large segments of intellectual life. The sciences say nothing, of course, about differences in values that are associated with particular right-wing and left-wing positions, such as in the trade-offs between unemployment and environmental protection, diversity and economic efficiency, or individual freedom and community cohesion. Nor do they speak directly to policies that are based on a complex mixture of assumptions about the world. But they do speak to the parts of the visions that are general claims about how the mind works. Those claims may be evaluated against the facts just like any empirical hypothesis. The utopian vision that human nature might radically change in some imagined society of the remote future is, of course, literally unfalsifiable. But I think that many of the discoveries recounted in preceding chapters make it unlikely. Among them, I would include the following. The primacy of family ties in all human societies and the consequent appeal of nepotism and inheritance. The limited scope of communal sharing in human groups. The more common ethos of reciprocity, and the resulting phenomena of social loafing and the collapse of contributions to public goods when reciprocity cannot be implemented. The universality of dominance and violence across human societies, including supposedly peaceable hunter-gatherers, and the existence of genetic and neurological mechanisms that underlie it. The universality of ethnocentrism and other forms of group-against-group hostility across societies, and the ease with which such hostility can be aroused in people within our own society. The partial heritability of intelligence, conscientiousness, and antisocial tendencies, implying that some degree of inequality will arise even in perfectly fair economic systems, and that we therefore face an inherent trade-off between equality and freedom. The prevalence of defense mechanisms, self-serving biases, and cognitive dissonance reduction, by which people deceive themselves about their autonomy, wisdom, and integrity. The biases of the human moral sense, including a preference for kin and friends, a susceptibility to a taboo mentality, and a tendency to confuse morality with conformity, rank, cleanliness, and beauty. It is not just conventional scientific data that tell us the mind is not infinitely malleable. I think it is no coincidence that beliefs that were common among intellectuals in the 1960s, that democracies are obsolete, revolution is desirable, the police and armed forces dispensable, and society designable from the top down, are now rarer. The tragic vision and the utopian vision inspired historical events whose interpretations are much clearer than they were just a few decades ago. Those events can serve as additional data to test the vision's claims about human psychology. The visions contrast most sharply in the political revolutions they spawned. The first revolution with a utopian vision was the French Revolution. Recall Wordsworth's description of the times, with human nature seeming born again. The revolution overthrew the Ancien Régime and sought to begin from scratch with the ideals of liberty, equality, and fraternity, and a belief that salvation would come from vesting authority in a morally superior breed of leaders. The revolution, of course, sent one leader after another to the guillotine as each failed to measure up to usurpers who felt they had a stronger claim to wisdom and virtue. No political structure survived the turnover of personnel, leaving a vacuum that would be filled by Napoleon. The Russian Revolution was also animated by the utopian vision, and it also burned through a succession of leaders before settling into the personality cult of Stalin. The Chinese Revolution, too, put its faith in the benevolence and wisdom of a man who displayed, if anything, a particularly strong dose of human foibles like dominance, lust, and self-deception. The perennial limitations of human nature prove the futility of political revolutions based only on the moral aspirations of the revolutionaries. In the words of the song about revolution by The Who, "Meet the new boss, same as the old boss." Sowell points out that Marxism is a hybrid of the two visions. It invokes the tragic vision to interpret the past, when earlier modes of production left no choice but the forms of social organization known as feudalism and capitalism. But it invokes a utopian vision for the future, in which we can shape our nature in dialectical interaction with the material and social environment. In that new world, people will be motivated by self-actualization rather than self-interest, allowing us to realize the ideal, from each according to his abilities, to each according to his needs. Marx wrote that a communist society would be the genuine resolution of the antagonism between man and nature and between man and man. It is the true resolution of the conflict between existence and essence, objectification and self-affirmation, freedom and necessity, individual and species. It is the riddle of history, solved. It doesn't get any less tragic or more utopian than that. Marx dismissed the worry that selfishness and dominance would corrupt those carrying out the general will. For example, he waved off the anarchist Mikhail Bakunin's fear that the workers in charge would become despotic. If Mr. Bakunin were familiar just with the position of a manager in a workers' cooperative, he could send all his nightmares about authority to the devil. In the heyday of radical science, any proposal about human nature that conflicted with the Marxist vision was dismissed as self-evidently wrong. But history is a kind of experiment, albeit an imperfectly controlled one, and its data suggest that it was the radical assessment that got it wrong. Marxism is now almost universally recognized as an experiment that failed, at least in its worldly implementations. The nations that adopted it either collapsed, gave it up, or languish in backward dictatorships. As we saw in earlier chapters, the ambition to remake human nature turned its leaders into totalitarian despots and mass murderers. And the assumption that central planners were morally disinterested and cognitively competent enough to direct an entire economy led to comical inefficiencies with serious consequences. Even the more humane forms of European socialism have been watered down to the point where so-called communist parties have platforms that not long ago would have been called reactionary. Wilson, the world's expert on ants, may have had the last laugh in his verdict on Marxism. Wonderful theory, wrong species.
Two cheers for democracy, proclaimed E.M. Forster. Democracy is the worst form of government, except all those other forms that have been tried, said Winston Churchill.
These are encomiums worthy of the tragic vision. For all their flaws, liberal democracies appear to be the best form of large-scale social organization our sorry species has come up with so far. They provide more comfort and freedom, more artistic and scientific vitality, longer and safer lives, and less disease and pollution than any of the alternatives. Modern democracies never have famines, almost never wage war on one another, and are the top choice of people all over the world who vote with their feet or with their boats. The modern success of democracies, like the failures of radical revolutions and of Marxist governments, is now widely enough agreed upon that it may serve as another empirical test for rival theories of human nature. The modern concept of democracy emerged in 17th and 18th century England, and was refined in the frenzy of theorizing that surrounded the American independence movement. It is no coincidence that the major theoreticians of the social contract, such as Hobbes, Locke, and Hume, were also major armchair psychologists. As Madison wrote, "What is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature?" The brains behind the American Revolution, which is sometimes labeled with the oxymoron conservative revolution, inherited the tragic vision of thinkers like Hobbes and Hume. Significantly, the founders appear not to have been influenced by Rousseau at all, and the popular belief that they got the idea of democracy from the Iroquois Federation is just 1960s granola. The legal scholar John McGinnis has argued that their theory of human nature could have come right out of modern evolutionary psychology. It acknowledges the desire of individuals to further their interests in the form of an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The state emerges from an agreement instituted to protect those rights, rather than being the embodiment of an autonomous superorganism. Rights need to be protected because when people live together, their different talents and circumstances will lead some of them to possess things that others want. Men have different and unequal faculties for acquiring property, noted Madison. There are two ways to get something you want from other people: steal it or trade for it. The first involves the psychology of dominance. The second, the psychology of reciprocal altruism. The goal of a peaceful and prosperous society is to minimize the use of dominance, which leads to violence and waste, and to maximize the use of reciprocity, which leads to gains in trade that make everyone better off. The Constitution, McGinnis shows, was consciously designed to implement these goals. It encouraged reciprocal exchanges through the Commerce Clause, which authorized Congress to remove barriers to trade imposed by the states. It protected them from the danger of cheaters through the Contracts Clause, which prevented states from impairing the enforcement of contracts. And it precluded rulers from confiscating the fruits of the more productive citizens via the Takings Clause, which forbid the government to expropriate private property without compensation. The feature of human nature that most impressed the framers was the drive for dominance and esteem, which, they feared, imperils all forms of government. Someone must be empowered to make decisions and enforce laws, and that someone is inherently vulnerable to corruption. How to anticipate and limit that corruption became an obsession of the framers. John Adams wrote, "The desire for the esteem of others is as real a want of nature as hunger. It is the principal end of government to regulate this passion.
Alexander Hamilton wrote. The love of fame is the ruling passion of the noblest minds. James Madison wrote, If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. So external and internal controls there would be. Parchment barriers, said Madison, were not enough. Rather, ambition must be made to counteract ambition. Checks and balances were instituted to stalemate any faction that grew too powerful. They included the division of authority between federal and state governments, the separation of powers among the executive, legislative, and judiciary branches, and the splitting of the legislative branch into two houses. Madison was especially adamant that the Constitution rein in the part of human nature that encourages war, which is not a primitive lust for blood, he claimed, but an advanced lust for esteem. War, in fact, is the true nurse of executive aggrandizement. In war, a physical force is created, and it is the executive will to direct it. In war, the public treasuries are to be unlocked, and it is the executive hand which is to dispense them. In war, the honors and emoluments of office are to be multiplied, and it is the executive patronage under which they are to be enjoyed. It is in war, finally, that laurels are to be gathered, and it is the executive brow they are to encircle. The strongest passions and the most dangerous weakness of the human breast, ambition, avarice, vanity, the honorable or venial love of fame, are all in conspiracy against the desire and duty of peace. This inspired the War Powers Clause, which gave Congress, not the President, the power to declare war. It was infamously circumvented in the years of the Vietnam conflict, during which Johnson and Nixon never formally declared a state of war. McGinnis notes that even the freedoms of speech, assembly, and the press were motivated by features of human nature. The framers justified them as means of preventing tyranny. A network of freely communicating citizens can counteract the might of the individuals in government. As we now say, they can speak truth to power. The dynamic of power sharing protected by these rights might go way back in evolutionary history. The primatologists Franz de Waal, Robin Dunbar, and Christopher Bohm have shown how a coalition of lower-ranking primates can depose a single alpha male. Like McGinnis, they suggest this may be a crude analog of political democracy. None of this means that the American Constitution was a guarantee of a happy and moral society, of course. By working within the glaringly undersized moral circle of the day, the Constitution failed to stand in the way of the genocide of native peoples, the slavery and segregation of African Americans, and the disenfranchisement of women. It said little about the conduct of foreign affairs, which, except with regard to strategic allies, has generally been guided by a cynical realpolitik. The first failing has been addressed by explicit measures to expand the legal circle, such as the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. The second is unsolved and perhaps unsolvable, because other countries are necessarily outside any circle delineated by a national document. The Constitution also lacked any principled compassion for those at the bottom of the meritocracy, assuming that equality of opportunity was the only mechanism needed to address the distribution of wealth. And it is incapable of stipulating the suite of values and customs that appear to be necessary for a democracy to function in practice. Acknowledging the relative success of constitutional democracy does not require one to be a flag-waving patriot, but it does suggest that something may have been right about the theory of human nature that guided its architects. The Left Needs a New Paradigm. Peter Singer, A Darwinian Left, 1999. Conservatives Need Charles Darwin. Larry Arnhart, Conservatives, Design, and Darwin, 2000. What's going on? That voices of the contemporary left and the contemporary right are both embracing evolutionary psychology after decades of reviling it shows two things. One is that biological facts are beginning to box in plausible political philosophies.
the belief on the left that human nature can be changed at will, and the belief on the right that morality rests on God's endowing us with an immaterial soul, are becoming rearguard struggles against the juggernaut of science. A popular bumper sticker in the 1990s urged, "Question authority." Another bumper sticker replied, "Question gravity." All political philosophies have to decide when their arguments are turning into the questioning of gravity. The second development is that an acknowledgement of human nature can no longer be associated with the political right. Once the utopian vision is laid to rest, the field of political positions is wide open. The tragic vision, after all, has not been vindicated in anything like its most lugubrious form. For all its selfishness, the human mind is equipped with a moral sense, whose circle of application has expanded steadily and might continue to expand as more of the world becomes interdependent. And for all its limitations, human cognition is an open-ended combinatorial system, which in principle can increase its mastery over human affairs, just as it has increased its mastery of the physical and living worlds. Traditions, for their part, are adapted not to human nature alone, but to human nature in the context of an infrastructure of technology and economic exchange. One does not have to be a Marxist to accept this insight from Marx. Some traditional institutions, like families and the rule of law, may be adapted to eternal features of human psychology. Others, such as primogeniture, were obviously adapted to the demands of a feudal system that required keeping the family lands intact, and became obsolete when the economic system changed in the wake of industrialization. More recently, feminism was in part a response to improved reproductive technologies and the shift to a service economy. Because social conventions are not adapted to human nature alone, a respect for human nature does not require preserving all of them. For these reasons, I think political beliefs will increasingly cut across the centuries-old divide between the tragic and utopian visions. They will diverge by invoking different aspects of human nature, by giving different weightings to conflicting goals, or by offering different assessments of the likely outcomes of particular courses of action. I end the chapter with a tour of some thinkers on the left who are scrambling the traditional alignment between human nature and right-wing politics. As its title suggests, a Darwinian left is the most systematic attempt to map out the new alignment. Singer writes, "It is time for the left to take seriously the fact that we are evolved animals, and that we bear the evidence of our inheritance not only in our anatomy and our DNA, but in our behavior too." For Singer, this means acknowledging the limits of human nature, which makes the perfectibility of humankind an impossible goal. And it means acknowledging specific components of human nature. They include self-interest, which implies that competitive economic systems will work better than state monopolies, the drive for dominance, which makes powerful governments vulnerable to overweening autocrats, ethnocentrism, which puts nationalist movements at risk of committing discrimination and genocide, and differences between the sexes, which should temper measures for rigid gender parity in all walks of life. "So what's left of the left?" an observer might ask. Singer replies, "If we shrug our shoulders at the avoidable suffering of the weak and the poor, of those who are getting exploited and ripped off, or who simply do not have enough to sustain life at a decent level, we are not of the left. If we say that that is just the way the world is and always will be, and there is nothing we can do about it, we are not part of the left. The left wants to do something about this situation." Singer's leftism, like traditional leftism, is defined by a contrast with a defeatist tragic vision. But its goal, doing something, has been downsized considerably from Robert Kennedy's goal in the 1960s of building a new world society. The Darwinian left has ranged from vague expressions of values to wonkish policy initiatives. We have already met two theoreticians at the vaguer end. Chomsky has been the most vocal defender of an innate cognitive endowment since he nailed his thesis of an inborn language faculty to the behaviorist's door in the late 1950s. He has also been a fierce left-wing critic of American society and has recently inspired a whole new generation of campus radicals, as we saw in his interview with Rage Against the Machine. Chomsky insists that the connections between his science and his politics are slender but real. A vision of a future social order is based on a concept of human nature. If, in fact, man is an indefinitely malleable, completely plastic being, with no innate structures of mind and no intrinsic needs of a cultural or social character, then he is a fit subject for the shaping of behavior by the state authority, the corporate manager, the technocrat, or the central committee. Those with some confidence in the human species will hope this is not so, and will try to determine the intrinsic characteristics that provide the framework for intellectual development, the growth of moral consciousness, cultural achievement, and participation in a free community. He describes his political vision as libertarian socialist and anarcho-syndicalist, the kind of anarchism that values spontaneous cooperation, as opposed to anarcho-capitalism, the kind that values individualism. This vision, he suggests, lies in a Cartesian tradition that includes Rousseau's opposition to tyranny, oppression, and established authority, Kant's defense of freedom, Humboldt's pre-capitalist liberalism, with its emphasis on the basic human need for free creation under conditions of voluntary association, and Marx's critique of alienated, fragmented labor that turns men into machines, depriving them of their species character of free conscious activity and productive life in association with their fellows. Chomsky's political beliefs, then, resonate with his scientific belief that humans are innately endowed with a desire for community and a drive for creative free expression, language being the paradigm example. That holds out the hope for a society organized by cooperation and natural productivity, rather than by hierarchical control and the profit motive. Chomsky's theory of human nature, though strongly innatist, is innocent of modern evolutionary biology, with its demonstration of ubiquitous conflicts of genetic interest. These conflicts lead to a darker view of human nature, one that has always been a headache for those with anarchist dreams. But the thinker who first elucidated these conflicts, Robert Trivers, was a left-wing radical as well, and one of the rare white Black Panthers. As we saw in Chapter 6, Trivers viewed sociobiology as a subversive discipline. A sensitivity to conflicts of interest can illuminate the interests of repressed agents, such as women and younger generations, and it can expose the deception and self-deception that elites use to justify their dominance. In that way, sociobiology follows in the liberal tradition of Locke by using science and reason to debunk the rationalizations of rulers. Reason was used in Locke's time to question the divine right of kings, and may be used in our time to question the pretension that current political arrangements serve everyone's interests. Though it may come as a shock to many people, the use of IQ tests and a recognition of innate differences in intelligence can support, and in the past did support, left-wing political goals. In his article, Bell Curve Liberals, the journalist Adrian Woodridge points out that IQ testing was welcomed by the British left as the ultimate subverter of a caste society ruled by inbred upper-class twits. Together with other liberals and socialists, Sidney and Beatrice Webb hoped to turn the educational system into a capacity-catching machine that could rescue talented poverty from the shop or the plow and direct them into the ruling elite. They were opposed by conservatives such as T.S. Eliot, who worried that a system that sorts people by ability would disorganize civil society by breaking the bonds of class and tradition at both ends of the ladder. At one end, it would fragment working-class communities, dividing them by talent. At the other, it would remove the ethic of noblesse oblige from the upper classes, who now would have earned their success and be responsible to no one, rather than inheriting it and being obligated to help the less fortunate. Woodridge argues that the left can hardly afford to ignore IQ tests, which, for all their inadequacies, are still the best means yet devised for spotting talent wherever it occurs, in the inner cities as well as the plush housing estates,
and ensuring that talent is matched to the appropriate educational streams and job opportunities. For their part, Richard Herrnstein and Charles Murray, the authors of The Bell Curve, argued that the heritability of intelligence ought to galvanize the left into a greater commitment to Rawlsian social justice. If intelligence were entirely acquired, then policies for equal opportunity would suffice to guarantee an equitable distribution of wealth and power. But if some souls have the misfortune of being born into brains with lower ability, they could fall into poverty through no fault of their own, even in a perfectly fair system of economic competition. If social justice consists of seeing to the well-being of the worst off, then recognizing genetic differences calls for an active redistribution of wealth. Indeed, though Herrnstein was a conservative and Murray a right-leaning libertarian and communitarian, they were not opposed to simple redistributive measures, such as a negative income tax for the lowest wage earners, which would give a break to those who play by the rules but still can't scrape by. Murray's libertarianism leads him to oppose government programs that are more activist than that. But he and Herrnstein noted that a hereditarian left is a niche waiting to be filled. An important challenge to conservative political theory has come from behavioral economists such as Richard Thaler and George Akerlof, who were influenced by the evolutionary cognitive psychology of Herbert Simon, Amos Tversky, Daniel Kahneman, Gerd Geigerenzer, and Paul Slovak. These psychologists have argued that human thinking and decision-making are biological adaptations rather than engines of pure rationality. These mental systems work with limited amounts of information, have to reach decisions in a finite amount of time, and ultimately serve evolutionary goals such as status and security. Conservatives have always invoked limitations on human reason to rein in the pretense that we can understand social behavior well enough to redesign society. But those limitations also undermine the assumption of rational self-interest that underlies classical economics and secular conservatism. Ever since Adam Smith, classical economists have argued that in the absence of outside interference, individuals making decisions in their own interests will do what is best for themselves and for society. But if people do not always calculate what is best for themselves, they might be better off with the taxes and regulations that classical economists find so perverse. For example, rational agents informed by interest rates and their life expectancies should save the optimal proportion of their wages for comfort in their old age. Social security and mandatory savings plans should be unnecessary, indeed harmful, because they take away choice and hence the opportunity to find the best balance between consuming now and saving for the future. But economists repeatedly find that people spend their money like drunken sailors. They act as if they think they will die in a few years, or as if the future is completely unpredictable, which may be closer to the reality of our evolutionary ancestors than it is to life today. If so, then allowing people to manage their own savings, for example, letting them keep their entire paycheck and investing it as they please, may work against their interests. Like Odysseus approaching the island of the Sirens, people might rationally agree to let their employer or the government tie them to the mast of forced savings. The economist Robert Frank has appealed to the evolutionary psychology of status to point out other shortcomings of the rational actor theory and, by extension, laissez-faire economics. Rational actors should eschew not only forced retirement savings, but other policies that ostensibly protect them, such as mandatory health benefits, workplace safety regulations, unemployment insurance, and union dues. All of these cost money that would otherwise go into their paychecks, and workers could decide for themselves whether to take a pay cut to work for a company with the most paternalistic policies, or go for the biggest salary and take higher risks on the job. Companies, in their competition for the best employees, should find the balance demanded by the employees they want. The rub, Frank points out, is that people are endowed with a craving for status. Their first impulse is to spend money in ways that put themselves ahead of the Joneses, houses, cars, clothing, prestigious educations, rather than in ways that only they know about, health care, job safety, retirement savings. Unfortunately, status is a zero-sum game, so when everyone has more money to spend on cars and houses, the houses and cars get bigger, but people are no happier than they were before. Like hockey players who agree to wear helmets only if a rule forces their opponents to wear them too. People might agree to regulations that force everyone to pay for hidden benefits like health care that make them happier in the long run, even if the regulations come at the expense of disposable income. For the same reason, Frank argues, we would be better off if we implemented a steeply graduated tax on consumption, replacing the current graduated tax on income. A consumption tax would damp down the futile arms race for ever more lavish cars, houses, and watches, and compensate people with resources that provably increase happiness, such as leisure time, safer streets, and more pleasant commuting and working conditions. Finally, Darwinian leftists have been examining the evolutionary psychology of economic inequality. The economists Samuel Bowles and Herbert Gintis, formerly Marxist and now Darwinians, have reviewed the literature from ethnography and behavioral economics, which suggests that people are neither ant-like altruists nor self-centered misers. As we saw in Chapter 14, people share with others who they think are willing to share, and punish those who are not. Gintis calls this strong reciprocity, which is like reciprocal altruism or weak reciprocity, but is aimed at other people's willingness to contribute to public goods, rather than at tit-for-tat exchanges. This psychology makes people oppose indiscriminate welfare and expansive social programs, not because they are callous or greedy, but because they think such programs reward the indolent and punish the industrious. Bowles and Gintis note that even in today's supposedly anti-welfare climate, polls show that most people are willing to pay higher taxes for some kinds of universal social insurance. They are willing to pay to guarantee basic needs such as food, shelter, and health care, to aid the victims of bad luck, and to help people who are down and out become self-sufficient. In other words, people are opposed to a blanket welfare state not out of greed but out of fairness. A welfare system that did not try to rewrite the public consciousness, and which distinguished between the deserving and the undeserving poor, would, they argue, be perfectly consonant with human nature. The politics of economic inequality ultimately hinge on a trade-off between economic freedom and economic equality. Though scientists cannot dictate how these desiderata should be weighted, they can help assess the morally relevant costs and thereby enable us to make a more informed decision. Once again, the psychology of status and dominance has a role to play in this assessment. In absolute terms, today's poor are materially better off than the aristocracy of just a century ago. They live longer, are better fed, and enjoy formerly unimaginable luxuries such as central heating, refrigerators, telephones, and round-the-clock entertainment from television and radio. Conservatives say this makes it hard to argue that the station of lower-income people is an ethical outrage that ought to be redressed at any cost. But if people's sense of well-being comes from an assessment of their social status, and social status is relative, then extreme inequality can make people on the lower rungs feel defeated, even if they are better off than most of humanity. It is not just a matter of hurt feelings. People with lower status are less healthy and die younger, and communities with greater inequality have poorer health and shorter life expectancies. The medical researcher Richard Wilkinson, who documented these patterns, argues that low status triggers an ancient stress reaction that sacrifices tissue repair and immune function for an immediate fight-or-flight response. Wilkinson, together with Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, have pointed to another measurable cost of economic inequality. Crime rates are much higher in regions with greater disparities of wealth, even after controlling for absolute levels of wealth, partly because chronic low status leads men to become obsessed with rank and to kill one another over trivial insults. Wilkinson argues that reducing economic inequality would make millions of lives happier, safer, and longer. This well-populated gallery of left-wing innatists should not come as a surprise,
even after centuries in which human nature was a preserve of the right. Mindful both of science and of history, the Darwinian left has abandoned the utopian vision that brought so many unintended disasters. Whether this non-utopian left is really all that different from the contemporary secular right, and whether its particular policies are worth their costs, is not for me to argue here. The point is that traditional political alignments ought to change as we learn more about human beings. The ideologies of the left and the right took shape before Darwin, before Mendel, before anyone knew what a gene or a neuron or a hormone was. Every student of political science is taught that political ideologies are based on theories of human nature. Why must they be based on theories that are 300 years out of date? Chapter 17. Violence. The story of the human race is war. Except for brief and precarious interludes, there has never been peace in the world. And long before history began, murderous strife was universal and unending. Winston Churchill's summary of our species could be dismissed as the pessimism of a man who fought history's most awful war and was present at the birth of a Cold War that could have destroyed humanity altogether. In fact, it has sadly stood the test of time. Though the Cold War is a memory, and hot wars between major nations are rare, we still do not have peace in the world. Even before the infamous year of 2001, with its horrific terrorist attacks on the United States and subsequent war in Afghanistan, the World Conflict List cataloged 68 areas of systematic violence, from Albania and Algeria through Zambia and Zimbabwe. Churchill's speculation about prehistory has also been borne out. Modern foragers, who offer a glimpse of life in prehistoric societies, were once thought to engage only in ceremonial battles that were called to a halt as soon as the first man fell. Now they are known to kill one another at rates that dwarf the casualties from our world wars. The archaeological record is no happier. Buried in the ground and hidden in caves lie silent witnesses to a bloody prehistory stretching back hundreds of thousands of years. They include skeletons with scalping marks, axe-shaped dents, and arrowheads embedded in them. Weapons like tomahawks and maces that are useless for hunting but specialized for homicide. Fortification defenses such as palisades of sharpened sticks. And paintings from several continents showing men firing arrows, spears, or boomerangs at one another and being felled by these weapons. For decades, anthropologists of peace denied that any human group had ever practiced cannibalism. But evidence to the contrary has been piling up and now includes a smoking gun. In an 850-year-old site in the American Southwest, archaeologists have found human bones that were hacked up like the bones of animals used for food. They also found traces of human myoglobin, a muscle protein, on pot shards and, damningly, in a lump of fossilized human excrement. Members of Homo antecessor, relatives of the common ancestor of Neanderthals and modern humans, bashed and butchered one another too, suggesting that violence and cannibalism go back at least 800,000 years. War is only one of the ways in which people kill other people. In much of the world, war shades into smaller-scale violence such as ethnic strife, turf battles, blood feuds, and individual homicides. Here, too, despite undeniable improvements, we do not have anything like peace. Though Western societies have seen murder rates fall between tenfold and a hundredfold in the past millennium, the United States lost 1 million people to homicide in the 20th century, and an American man has about a 0.5% lifetime chance of being murdered. History indicts our species not just with the number of killings, but with the manner. Hundreds of millions of Christians decorate their homes and adorn their bodies with a facsimile of a device that inflicted an unimaginably agonizing death on people who were a nuisance to Roman politicians. It is just one example of the endless variations of torture that the human mind has devised over the millennia, many of them common enough to have become words in our lexicon. To crucify, to draw and quarter, to flay, to press, to stone. The garrote, the rack, the stake, the thumbscrew. Dostoevsky's Ivan Karamazov, learning of the atrocities committed by the Turks in Bulgaria, said, "No animal could ever be so cruel as a man, so artfully, so artistically cruel." The annual reports of Amnesty International show that artistic cruelty is by no means a thing of the past. The reduction of violence on scales large and small is one of our greatest moral concerns. We ought to use every intellectual tool available to understand what it is about the human mind and human social arrangements that leads people to hurt and kill so much. But as with the other moral concerns examined in this part of the audiobook, the effort to figure out what is going on has been hijacked by an effort to legislate the correct answer. In the case of violence, the correct answer is that violence has nothing to do with human nature, but is a pathology inflicted by malign elements outside us. Violence is a behavior taught by the culture, or an infectious disease endemic to certain environments. This hypothesis has become the central dogma of a secular faith, repeatedly avowed in public proclamations like a daily prayer or pledge of allegiance. Recall Ashley Montague's UNESCO resolution that biology supports an ethic of universal brotherhood, and the anthropologists who believe that nonviolence and peace were likely the norm throughout most of human prehistory. In the 1980s, many social science organizations endorsed the Seville Statement, which declared that it is scientifically incorrect to say that humans have a violent brain or have undergone selection for violence. "War is not an instinct, but an invention," wrote Ortega y Gasset, paralleling his claim that man has no nature, but only history. A recent United Nations declaration on the elimination of violence against women announced that violence is part of an historical process and is not natural or born of biological determinism. A 1999 ad by the National Funding Collaborative on Violence Prevention declared that violence is learned behavior. Another sign of this faith-based approach to violence is the averred certainty that particular environmental explanations are correct. We know the causes of violence, it is repeatedly said, and we also know how to eliminate it. Only a failure of commitment has prevented us from doing so. Remember Lyndon Johnson saying that all of us know that the conditions that breed violence are ignorance, discrimination, poverty, and disease. A 1997 article on violence in a popular science magazine quoted a clinical geneticist who echoed LBJ. "We know what causes violence in our society. Poverty, discrimination, the failure of our educational system. It's not the genes that cause violence in our society, it's our social system." The authors of the article, the historians Betty and Daniel Kevles, agreed. "We need better education, nutrition, and intervention in dysfunctional homes, and in the lives of abused children, perhaps to the point of removing them from the control of their incompetent parents. But such responses would be expensive and socially controversial." The creed that violence is learned behavior often points to particular elements of American culture as the cause. A member of a toy monitoring group recently told a reporter, "Violence is a learned behavior. Every toy is educational. The question is, what do you want your children to learn?" Media violence is another usual suspect. As two public health experts recently wrote, "The reality is that children learn to value and use violence to solve their problems and deal with strong feelings. They learn it from role models in their families and communities. They learn it from the heroes we put in front of them on television, the movies, and video games." Childhood abuse, recently implicated in Richard Rhodes's Why They Kill, is a third putative cause. The tragedy is that people who have been victimized often become victimizers themselves, said the president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. "It's a cycle we could break, but it involves some expense. As a society, we haven't put our resources there." Note in these statements the mouthing of the creed, "Violence is a learned behavior," the certainty that it is true, the reality is, and the accusation that we suffer from a lack of commitment, we haven't put our resources there, rather than an ignorance of how to solve the problem. Many explanations blame culture, conceived as a superorganism that teaches, issues commands, and doles out rewards and punishments. A Boston Globe columnist must have been oblivious to the circularity of his reasoning when he wrote, "So why is America more violent than other industrialized Western democracies? It's our cultural predisposition to violence. We pummel each other, maul each other, stab each other, and shoot each other because it's our cultural imperative to do so." When culture is seen as an entity with beliefs and desires, the beliefs and desires of actual people are unimportant.